Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of discussion with scholars, artists, and other producers of knowledge and culture about research and memory. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm excited to have on the program today John Long, professor of biology and cognitive science here at Vassar College, to talk with us about evolution, fish, and robots, and about his book, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology, published this year by Basic Books. Welcome, John.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Yeah, it's really great to have you here. First, I just want to say it's wonderful to see research in evolutionary biology and biology per se getting so much attention. Science magazine listed Darwin's Devices as one of its top reads on its spring list this year, and the book's received excellent reviews in a host of media, including Science, Nature, Slate, and many other scientific and popular outlets. Barnes & Noble highlighted the book in its hot books list. So, you know, my question is, why all this interest in the book, do you think? Is it the sexiness of the idea of robots rubbing off, in this case, on the field of evolutionary biology? Is it about a breakthrough discovery, or is it just that you've hit into something in yourself that you've been working away all these years as a researcher, not realizing you are also a brilliant, can't-put-the-book-down science writer?
I don't think it's the last one there. I think there has been an interest in, first of all, publishing it, or it wouldn't have gotten this far. And I think that interest, as you say, is this combination of two very interesting topics, the robotics on the one hand and evolution on the other. And it's got a sort of timeliness, at least from a science point of view, when you explore the limits of a field like biology and you claim, as I'm claiming, that, hey, I've got a new tool to get us further in our explorations of life by studying robots.
Mm-hmm. So the payoff is not just what you learn from the research in terms of biology, but it's also what you learn about doing research.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a process that we engage in that actually helps test our ideas just in the process itself about what we know. And one of the things about using robots in biology is that we are building these robots to be models of animals. And so the process of modeling is an intellectual one where you say, I'm going to build something. That something as a model can be a set of equations. It can be a computer simulation with algorithms, or it can be, in our case, a physically embodied creature, if you will, artificial creature. And that model, you engage logically and say, this is a representation of the thing I'm trying to study, the target, the animal. And anything I learn about that model tells me something about the animal itself. And so that's a whole philosophical area of, can you actually model or not? And that's very controversial. There's some very clear thinkers who say, you know, the best model of a cat is a cat.
Is a cat, yeah, Norbert Wiener.
Oh, very good,
yes. So can you tell us in general terms, very general terms, just about the nature of your research and how robots and organisms, what they have to do with one another?
Sure, and let me get to the kind of motivation to help you understand where or why I'm doing this crazy stuff. What's the crazy stuff? Well, I evolve robots to try to study the evolution of animals. So in a nutshell, that's what we're doing. And when I say we, that includes students here at Vassar College. Mm-hmm. It includes colleagues that I have at other institutions. Rob Root, who's actually a Vassar College class of 79, STS and math double major, who's at Lafayette College. Mm-hmm. He's involved in this work. And Chun-Wai Lu, who's a computer scientist professor at Lafayette College. His wife, Judy, actually was a Vassar grad. So there's this kind of Vassar cabal that's working on this stuff. And we're doing it because, as biologists, we get frustrated because there are certain things we can't know using traditional biological tools. You can't, as much as I would like to, hop in your TARDIS with the doctor and fly back to 500 million years ago and watch evolution as it's unfolding in front of you. So what do you do? Dead fossils don't tell any tales. So trying to find a new way, if you will, to reanimate these ancient fossils so that we can watch them behave in front of us and understand the mechanism whereby natural selection, which is the primary creative agent of evolution, causes the first vertebrates to evolve. Mm-hmm. And so we are vertebrate animals, and vertebrates are so named because of the bones in our backbone, which cause us to curse as we get older and the joints fail and things like that.
I know very well.
But this is really our evolutionary history, our inner fish, if you will, because the first vertebrates were fish. And so my interest in fish goes back to the fact that I'm interested in this whole group of organisms called vertebrates and our incredible evolutionary history. And so wanting to go back and try to understand, almost like crime scene investigation, want to go back and reconstruct what happened in the evolutionary crime scene.
Interesting. I've heard historians talk about their research as being somewhat like murder investigation, you know, sort of thing you see in mysteries, and science apparently can be conducted in the same way or has something in common with that kind of methodology.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the operative word, as you mentioned, is history.
Yeah.
Right. It's history in the sense that it's already happened.
Yes.
And so in the sciences, we have the same issues that historians have when they're dealing with human events. Cosmologists have to deal with this when they go back and they try to understand the origins of the universe.
Yeah.
And if I want to understand the origin of vertebrates, we have to do things, model. We have to use our minds, our imagination to try to understand what might have been possible. And that's the thing about this that gets some scientists uncomfortable, which is, well, how do you know that you really have the right answer when you do these robots? And you don't. So we do what I call circumscribing the possible, drawing a circle around what we think are the most likely or the most probable events, and leaving the other kinds of events that are less likely outside of that sphere of probability.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit more about the problem of representation that you talk about at length in the first chapter of the book, which I found very interesting? You know, what do robots, mechanical objects constructed by human beings, have to do with biological organisms?
Yeah, I mean, you've put your finger on something I think that's really interesting. I'm in the biology department here at Vassar. I'm also in the cognitive science program. I have a half-time appointment in both. Why do I bring that up? In cognitive science, the issue of representation is central to philosophy of mind issues. What is it that mind does? And the classic artificial intelligence view of that is the mind takes representations of the so-called external world, as if there's a difference between the internal mentalism and the rest of the world. It takes the representations of the external world and it operates those representations as if they were symbols, right, in a rule-based manner. So it's central to good old-fashioned artificial intelligence to have this idea of representations. Well, along comes embodied artificial intelligence, where you get into things like embodied robots and why build them and not simulate them on the computer. And you find that, you know what, there are behaviors that we can get robots to accomplish, and yet there is no internal representation of the world whatsoever. So there's a famous roboticist named Rodney Brooks, who in the 1980s at MIT talked about, we don't need internal world models, that in fact, the world is its own best model. And we gain some insight into this idea when we think about humans do tasks like copying or transcribing a piece of paper. You don't read a whole page and then move to your blank page and scribble out what you've just read, right? You read a few words, move over, and you go back and forth there. And the thought is, we know, without having to think about it, what's available to us in the world, right? So we don't have to convert everything to memory and then take like a snapshot of the world.
Right, it's everything doesn't have to be data.
Exactly. It's an interactive process, and we go back and forth in these things. And so the idea that we are walking around in our brains doing sort of like supercomputer work of taking snapshots and identifying all the objects and everything doesn't seem to really jibe with how human psychology works or animal behavior works, for that matter. Now, there's that idea of throw away what Brooks called the cognition box or the representation box, as we're talking about here. Get rid of representations. Can you still have thinking and cognition? Yeah, you can. But then what do you miss? What's lacking from there? So Brooks developed this idea of behavior-based robotics. He was inspired by insects, actually, that don't have much in the way of brain. And he said, well, look, they're very successful evolutionarily. Maybe we're doing this whole robotics thing backwards. We shouldn't start with humans. Let's start with so-called simpler organisms like insects and then see if we can do insect-like robots and then incrementally add in pieces of brain or intelligence or behavior and see if we can get to humans, which, by the way, we haven't gotten to yet. So where do representations come in? They come in with how do you bridge that gap between human-like animal behavior and what we think of as human behavior? And human behavior is very messy because we have this internal life of the mind, which we want to somehow recover in our robots, right? That we're talking to ourselves in our head is the sort of classic thing.
And that's cybernetics, that everything is information.
Right, that information is independent somehow of the physical instantiation of the information actor, if you will. And so representations then are thought to be important when you want a robot to do something that's an extended type of behavior. So anytime you want a robot to remember something, then you start to invoke what some people would call a representation of the world. Even, for example, keeping track of how many times, if you're building a legged robot, how many times have your legs touched the ground? That's memory. So as soon as you invoke memory, you get to these ideas. Well, now what am I doing? I'm representing my limb movements. I'm representing something about time if I'm keeping track of how long I've done something. So these become representations. And it's really hard to do certain kinds of behaviors without those kind of representations, either about what you've just done or something about the world. And let me give you an example. With Google Cars, right now, Google is taking a lot of effort to go around and exhaustively map from a car point of view various parts of the world so that they can very soon introduce their commercial robotically operated car that has internal to it a map, so the Google map, so it knows where it is based on its GPS coordinates, but also a kind of map of what objects it's likely to encounter. So it can separate out, is that a lamp pole or is that a pedestrian? And Mercedes is doing this as well. They have some high-end object recognition kinds of software. So there are people who say, you know, you need representations of some type if you're going to have really intelligent cars, for example.
Interesting.
So that's representation from the cog-sci point of view. And then there's the representation of the modeling itself. When we do a computer model or we do a robotic model, we are saying that that model represents something about reality. So it's the same process that we claim is happening with our brains. But now we're doing it externally, and we call it scientific modeling. And there are different kinds of models out there. You know, there are models like weather models. And we've just learned from Hurricane Sandy, for example, that there are different kinds of models with different assumptions. And it turns out the Europeans probably have a better weather model than we have in North America because they predicted the surges of the tides a little bit better than the American models.
And models can be purely conceptual or informational.
You're absolutely right, so models can be purely conceptual, informational, if you mean in a text-like way. And they can be physical models. And so one of the criticisms that we get from people is, well, and you sort of started out your question this way, you know, what do your robots have to do with biology? And that's a really important question. And the first answer that I have when I get asked that is, well, look, do you think that you can learn anything by building a computer model? So what do you think?
Yes, certainly something can be learned. If nothing else, you learn about building computer models, right? Ordinarily, you assume if there is some kind of connection with reality in this representation, if you're going back and testing the representation, then yes, a computer model can certainly tell you something. You know, with a weather, say, model, if the, you know, if it rains on the day you predicted it's going to rain and it does that pretty consistently, you know you've got a good model, So
A good model in terms of predicting what's about to happen. In terms of the weather. So, so then how do you test your model and how do you judge if your model is good or not? And that's where a lot of differences come into play here. So for something like a robotic model, what I say is, okay, so if you believe in these computer models telling you something about the world and predicting, let's say, then a robot, if it's built to be this way, is another kind of model. So therefore, if you think that modeling is good doing it digitally, you can't say, oh, modeling is bad over here out of hand with robots just because it's built out of plastic and metal and wires. There needs to be some other way that you're judging if a model is good or not, as opposed to Weiner saying, you know, okay, well, no models are good. So if you're in the realm of saying, okay, it's okay to model, we can learn stuff about the world. If for nothing else, your point, we test our intuition. You know, if we assemble a model, a conceptual model or a physical model, can we do it in such a way that it helps us organize our thoughts about the world in such a way that either allows us to come up with predictions that we didn't have before, or understand something about the internal economy of the mechanisms that are operating to create the behavior we're interested in. That's another use of model. Sometimes the models are very useful because they help us understand what we don't know. Oh, you know, in the case of building our robotic models, something they're not good at, for example, is they don't have muscle-like motor systems. We actually use motors. And that's not biological. right? So we'd like a distributed muscle-type motor, which we don't have. Mm-hmm. So they're inaccurate in that regard in terms of their mechanism. But nobody has built a good and reliable muscle-like motor at this point.
You must have to be very thoughtful about your variables then generally, wondering what might be influencing, you know, an outcome and what may have influenced an outcome in a distant past that the model is missing.
Right. And you know, back to the point about every model is a simplification
of
the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it
sure.
needn't be, right? Yeah. But if you're not simplifying the world, then why are you doing it?
Yes.
And why do you simplify?
Interesting, yeah.
Right, you simplify because you're looking for those essential pieces of the world that explain what you're observing, or in the case of a fossil record, what you would have observed if you were back then, or what causes those patterns to be present there.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in explanations, then what we're after in terms of building our robots and picking up on what you just said about having to very carefully think about all your variables mm-hmm. is we use what's called the KISS principle, mm-hmm. which is keep it simple, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So start off with the simplest model that gives you a piece of whatever behavior of the world that you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So for us building these robots, the initial test of whether or not we have a good robot is, first of all, does it actually function in the physical world? Because unlike in a computer program, if you build a robot, you can't violate the laws of physics.
Yes.
And I violated the laws of physics on computers, mm-hmm. and we do it all the time in physics class. When the moment you say, okay, this block you're moving up this wedge is on a frictionless surface, ding, 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 you've just violated the laws of physics.
Yeah.
And you do it because you simplify the model. You don't have to account for friction then in your model. So that's fine. And now when we're building robots, if it doesn't work, you know what? The physics is telling us right away it's a test of our model by virtue of whether it works or not. The second level then is, okay, so now it works, it operates. I've got input coming through my sensory systems. I've got motor outputs. Can our robots operate autonomously? So what we mean by operating autonomously is they're not remote controlled. They're taking in their own sensory input and making decisions based on how they're designed to accomplish a task mm-hmm. about how they're going to move in the world. And so there's this wonderful dynamical systems interaction between the moment they start moving that changes the information that there is structured in their mm-hmm. world. So they get new information in their world through their sensory systems by virtue of the way they're moving through the world. So how they move is essential to how they perceive. So this is a fundamental element of the robotic models that we build, is this level of autonomy. So once we get physically embodied, autonomous robot, then we can worry about things like what sorts of structures are we going to put in here? If we're interested in the evolution of vertebrates, which structures are we going to model? You know, we're a whole assemblage of different structures that have their sort of own evolutionary history. I'm waving at you with my hands here, and I'm holding up five fingers, right? So the history of five fingers is really interesting because these digits evolved somewhere in our history of evolution towards land, right? We associate mm-hmm. digits as being involved with fish mm-hmm. moving on to land and becoming tetrapods, tetra, four, pod, foot, four-footed mm-hmm. creatures. Well, it turns out that based on some new fossils, we actually think that these digits evolved before those fish moved on to land. Okay, so that changes our idea. What was the original function in an evolutionary sense?
Fish with hands and feet.
Fish with hands and feet. So the thought is maybe these were near-shore critters. Mm-hmm. They were messing around in sticks and debris. They held on to things. They were interacting with the substrate, the bottom, and the debris in there in a way that we don't normally think about mm-hmm. fish interacting with stuff.
Interesting. So do you use computer modeling in your research?
Yeah, we do. And we do computer modeling. Rob Brood and Shunwai mm-hmm. Liu at Lafayette College are really the computer modelers.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to do similar things. We're evolving digital robots on computer as well. We also use some computers in our embodied robots mm-hmm. because the genetic systems that encode for the structures, we do that genetic work on the computer.
Yes, and the learning system where the artificial organism learns to go this way, not that way, is that computer controlled or is it?
If we were to invoke learning, which we haven't yet.
You haven't called it learning, but whatever it is.
That's right. That there is a onboard each of our robots, mm-hmm. there's a small computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now what these computers do is they take input from the sensory systems that we have on board, and they make a decision about turning that signal into some kind of motion to turn or to beat your tail faster, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Can you tell us about one of your typical robotic fish and how it functions in an experiment? Sort of walk us through the process from conception to result.
Sure. I would like to actually start sort of in the middle of the...
In medias res.
So what you would see if you were to walk into my lab over in the Olmsted Hall is you'd walk into a totally dark laboratory. We've painted all the walls black so that we can control the light and any reflections from other surfaces. We've done this because we have to create a world in which our robots behave. So this world is dark. We call the laboratory the abyss because the abyss is where there no light comes through in the ocean. So you walk into the abyss, and what do you see? You see a 10-foot diameter aquaculture tank that's in the middle of the floor. We fill this tank with water, and then we would pull off the shelves something that looks like, and I'm not kidding, a 2-liter Tupperware bowl that's got a computer in it. It's got stuff hanging off it. It's got little pieces of electronics. We take this Tupperware, turn on the computer, and we put it in the tank. And next thing you know, this Tupperware is swimming around. I'm not remote controlling anything, nothing in my, nothing but, no mirrors, no smoke. It's moving around, and what is it doing? Well, it's just swimming around the tank. And then we have a light that's hanging over this tank. Remember, the room is dark. Fortunately, our robot has little LEDs so we can see it moving around. We turn on the light over the tank, and suddenly the robot goes, oh, it doesn't say this, of course. I'm personifying it. But it responds to that difference in the light. It turns and it moves towards the light, and then it will orbit around that light source.
You have sensors then that function as something like eyes.
That's correct. Yeah, and those sensors are called photoresistors. In the latest versions of these robots, we take the difference in intensity that reaches each of these photoresistors on the left and right side. And that's the simple signal about where the light is. Take the difference and move towards the side that has
the most
that different
light.
Exactly right. So the robot can detect the light gradient, swim up it, and orbit around it. So that's its equivalent of feeding. And then in the...
Because in the ocean, the food nourishment would have been triggered by light, plankton and...
That's a great point, that all life starts with light. And photosynthesis that plants do, converting that light energy into glucose. Everybody wants their sugar buzz, right? And so, exactly right. So you go towards the light. And so then what we would do in our environment, if we're doing an evolutionary trial, we wouldn't put just one of these robots in the tank at a time. Maybe we'd put six. So they're swimming around. They're competing for getting to the light source.
They bump into one another?
They bump into each other, and that's...
Fish do that also.
Fish do that, right, sure. So it's a way to kind of limit the resources. And one of the things about evolution is natural selection, which is one of the processes that drives evolutionary change, is dependent on a particular place at a particular time. It's not an abstract thing that happens. It's a very concrete, specific process of what? Of determining who gets to reproduce, who gets to put their genes into the next generation. So we have our robots swimming around, and maybe in some trials we'll introduce a predator that's not evolving, but it's a different kind of selection pressure in there. So now you have to try to evade the predator while you're hunting for that food, which is, again, a very realistic ecological scenario. So we've created a world we think, even though it's very stripped down, very simple, we think it's very realistic in the sense that everybody has to eat and everybody has to not get eaten, right? At least until you reproduce. So since these are autonomous robots and we don't know what's going to happen, we videotape. So if you were to look up on this black ceiling, you'd see a camera that's recording these behavioral trials. And so we run for 3 or 6 minutes a trial. And then we had established before we even started that we were going to grade each one of these Tupperware robots that has, by the way, a flexible tail on it. In that tail, it's got a variable number of vertebrae. So one individual might have 5 of these little bones. Another individual might have 6. Another might have 4. We do that because variation is the stuff of life. Natural selection can't act if there's only one choice on the menu, right? So the whole deal with natural selection is it's the world and your interactions with the world determining at that place and time which is the best solution to survival. And it's not an optimization thing, and it's, oh, it's going to be engineeringly perfect. It just, you just have to be better than the individuals around you. You know, like the old joke about we're out hiking and we say, gosh, what if we see a grizzly bear? What are we going to do? Well, let's run. And then you say, well, but we're not supposed to run from a bear. And then you say, well, I only have to outrun you,
right? So, yeah, exactly.
So running might not be optimal, but it gets you get you your survival.
Survival, yeah.
So here we have the Tupperware. The propeller is this flexible, mm-hmm. vertebrate-like body that we specially designed using biomimetic engineering processes. Mm-hmm. We've built it out of collagen, which is the main protein that's in our tendons and ligaments. Mm-hmm. And so it's working away and propelling that Tupperware. It's taking the input through the sensors. We're recording the video. Then what do we do? The trial's over. Mm-hmm. Now we have to go to what's called a fitness function. Mm-hmm. We have to judge. We have to play the role of natural selection, which, you know, there's no natural selector out there. There's no, in the words of Frank Zappa, no central scrutinizer,
yes.
right,
yeah.
who is watching to see what happens. It's just what happens. As Darwin said, it's the daily and hourly scrutiny that life pays to other life forms mm-hmm. that determines sort of mm-hmm. what's happening. And so subtle, very small changes that add up over time.
Yeah.
So we think of it as sort of an evolutionary Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
There's a judging scheme. So we take the videos and then we have previously decided what's going to earn different individuals' points. And for any generation, we rank the individuals by how well they did mm-hmm. in the game of life. And so, for example, in one of the trials where we had both predators and then the prey we're also trying to eat, we rewarded, they got points for keeping their distance from the predator.
Mm-hmm.
When a predator did approach, doing what's called a fast start escape. So, and you want to do this with a lot of acceleration.
Yeah.
So accelerating quickly.
Fast twitch muscles, except in this case you don't have muscles, yes.
Exactly yeah. right. Swimming along quickly mm-hmm. because we think it's important to get to the food before mm-hmm. other individuals do. Once you get to the food, sticking around to it, can you tightly orbit the food?
Mm-hmm.
So we have rewards that are built into finding food and eating, and rewards that are built into not getting eaten. So we sit there and we painstakingly work our way frame by frame through this video,
mm-hmm.
score each individual's, and then we line them up and we say, we're going to allow the top three to take their genes
mm-hmm.
and we're going to mutate their genes, throw them together in what I call, in a not very tactful way, the mating bucket, which is an idea of putting sperm and eggs together and mm-hmm. shaking them up like a cocktail shaker and see how they recombine.
Yes.
So that's another random process.
Mm-hmm.
That then produces the genetic information to make the next generation mm-hmm. of these robots.
There must be slight physical differences between the robots that would cause one to be more genetically fit than the other.
That's absolutely right.
Okay.
So when we first begin our experiments, the first thing we do is for all the characters that we're interested mm-hmm. in seeing if they will evolve, right? And that's mm-hmm. always the question.
Yeah.
We don't go in
mm-hmm.
saying they're going to evolve.
Yes.
It's an open question, which is why you run the experiments. So let me just give you an example of a recent thing that we ran, where we allowed the number of vertebrae to evolve
mm-hmm.
in the backbone. We allowed the predator detection threshold to evolve. There's a special organ on the sides of fish called the lateral line.
Mm-hmm.
So that's emulating the lateral line. And then we allowed the shape of the caudal fin, the very end of the tail,
mm-hmm.
to change from being very pointy or mm-hmm. to have a large span like you might see mm-hmm. on a tuna. So we allowed all three of those characters to change, and we did so because in early fossil record, we see what looks like lots of evolutionary experiments in all three of those.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And so once we do that first generation, we randomly assign tail sizes, number of vertebrae, and sensitivity to predators to each of the individuals. And we say, okay, we're going to kind of close our eyes and say, okay, poof, here's a bunch of variation. Natural selection or selection, mm-hmm. do your thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so because we have our population of robots changing from generation to generation, we actually have evolution that's occurring in the laboratory with these robots.
I've often thought it interesting that the processes of evolution have an experimental cast to them, as if nature were a researcher trying to work out the solution to material problems through processes of trial and error, involving lots of failure, of course, but also occasional successes, except even often when there are successes, the experiment seems to be repeated over and over again. And you talk about the notion of convergent evolution. So could you talk just a bit about that and possibly also just dispel common misconceptions about evolution?
You're asking for a lot. Yeah, so convergent evolution is one of those patterns that we see in either living diversity or fossil diversity. And let me give you a classic example. I have this thing about wanting to be a fish myself, and be in the water.
Mr. Limpet.
yeah,
incredible, right. Mr. Limpet, yes.
Under the sea and all mm-hmm. that. And so I always think about aquatic vertebrates.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we see in the history of vertebrate life over the past 530 million years is there have been the first vertebrates, who were fish,
mm-hmm.
and we still have fish. So the common ancestor of living fishes were fish as well. And then we have aquatic vertebrates like whales and dolphins,
mm-hmm.
who, they were fish 500 130 million years ago, but their intermediate ancestors were actually land animals, and whales and dolphins and hippos share a common ancestor. So it was a legged land creature that gave rise to hippos and then dolphins and whales, right? So dolphins and whales are fully aquatic. They can't live on land, as you know, from strandings. So here in dolphins and whales, we see a shape and kind of animal that for many millennia, humans looked at and said, oh, there's a fish, right? So the Buddhists in Japan, who are not meat eaters, mm-hmm. will eat dolphin because it's not meat, it's from the ocean. Mm-hmm. Even though we know evolutionarily that dolphins are mammals,
mammals, yes.
Right? So, and they have red meat when, if you ever happen to see them cut open, and they carry with them all their evolutionary baggage. Mm-hmm. And they've lost, though, their hind limbs. Mm-hmm. They've got this new thing called flukes, which is an extension of the skin. Mm-hmm. If there's not bones in there that cause those sort of wings. So it's mm-hmm. a tail that's very unlike the tail of fish mm-hmm. that has little bony rays in it. And yet you can look at the shape of a dolphin and compare it to, for example, the shape of a mako shark. Mm-hmm. And they're very similar, similar sized. They have a streamlined kind of teardrop shape. They have a big lunate tail. And then it turns out there's also another kind of animal that's extinct called an ichthyosaur, which lived in the age of dinosaurs in the water. And it looks same size, very similar shape to dolphins. Mm-hmm. So those three animals have very different kinds of histories. So the sharks have never had an ancestor that was on land. But ichthyosaurs and dolphins had common ancestors that were on land. But ichthyosaurs are descended from early reptiles. Mm-hmm. And dolphins are descended from early mammals. Right, so tons of times, probably on the order of 350 million years since an ancestor was shared between any of these groups. And yet when you look at them, they look very similar. So this is a pattern of convergent evolution.
Yeah, similar morphologies, but very different histories then. Yes.
That's right. So it looks like, so biologists get all excited mm-hmm. because you go, ooh, look at this. Natural selection has generated a similar solution mm-hmm. to a similar problem. And in the case where we have these patterns, the question is not necessarily what the solution is, but what's the problem? The problem for all three of these species is being big and fast. So to be big and fast in the water means that you have to expend a lot of energy, a lot of power to move quickly. So I'm going to do a little bit of physics here. Mm-hmm. So power is the rate at which you use energy. Okay. Yes. So it turns out that the power to move a little bit faster in water scales to the third power of your velocity. Okay, as opposed to, I want to move from 5 miles an hour to 10 miles an hour and I just double my power. Yes. No, I do 8 times that power to move that much faster.
Mm-hmm. So sounds like my Jeep, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So why move fast if it's so energetically expensive to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, why drive your Jeep fast?
Yeah,
because it's
all
fun.
That fuel, you know, right? So.
But in terms of these animals, if you can swim fast and you're in the water, you can do a couple of things. You can cover a lot of territory quickly. Mm-hmm. And the thing about trying to make a living in the open ocean is it's not like there are fish that are just scattered everywhere ready for you to eat. The fish are clustered mm-hmm. in what we call patchy resources. So you have to go find where a school of fish are. And you have to be an energy speculator. What you're doing is you're speculating that you'll get there before you run out of fuel. Mm-hmm. But boy, when you get there, you better be able to hit the cheetah button, to borrow a terrestrial analogy, and be able to, bam, go into that school of fish and get a meal. So the idea with the streamlining that we see that's convergently or independently evolved at least 3 times in these very different kinds of aquatic vertebrates is that streamlining is the best you can do at reducing the cost to move around at high speed. Mm. So we have what we think is a good biomechanical explanation, and then we guess at what we think the evolutionary scenario was that may have caused that evolution to happen repeatedly. So that's why biologists get all excited about convergence as we go, see, natural selection, it really works, and depending on what you're starting with genetically, you can get animals that are would essentially be occupying the same ecological niche because they have evolved independently, and they look the same because that how they look is dictated by the function.
Yeah, interesting. You essentially repeat experiments in different circumstances getting the same results. So that would excite. And nature is, in a sense, a researcher then.
Yeah, so, no, your analogy is, I love your analogy there of working with the materials and doing independent experiments.
You mentioned many of your colleagues are Vassar students and you work with your students on your research. Can you talk about how students contribute to the research and the collaborative environment of science generally? which is something new to people in the humanities, but that we're slowly just beginning to get used to, actually. But in the sciences, it's the way things are done.
Yeah, working with undergraduates is a really interesting part of the job. And you mentioned the difference between the humanities, and we're always, maybe it's C.P. Snow that I'm referencing here. But, you know, there's
two
always,
cultures, yeah.
That's right. We're always feeling like we're, even though we're together at Vassar with our colleagues in the humanities, we're somehow in different worlds. Mm-hmm. And so let me mischaracterize what I think those worlds are. My sense from my humanities colleagues is for them being at UPenn or Vassar, there's not a lot of difference other than they don't have to worry about graduate students, right?
Yes.
They can do their scholarship, and it's a very similar kind of scholarship. Mm-hmm. For us in the sciences, it's very different because science is so labor-intensive that if I were at UPenn, I would have graduate students who would be working in the lab. I'd also have postdoctoral researchers who would be working in the lab. There would really be like a small, essentially a small cadre.
Workshop.
I love the idea of a workshop. Yeah. That's a good way to think of it. So when we're trying to become and remain active scholars at Vassar, an undergraduate institution, it's very difficult to do it on your own. There really is no like mad scientist by herself in the laboratory. It is, maybe it's a mad scientist and other mad scientists working together. And why is that? So, you know, there's this stereotype of the nerdy scientist who's no good working with people, so they go in the lab and they work in the lab. And in fact, the big joke is we all go work with each other in the lab. So it's this very social environment.
Yes, and it's like that across the sciences, isn't it? It's like that in biomedical research.
You walk into any lab, you'll find a gaggle of scientists working
so
with
each
other.
People in the humanities, as we're getting into the sort of data-intensive world with digital humanities, have a lot to learn from scientists and their colleagues in the sciences at academic institutions, I would think, about rethinking how research is conducted.
Yeah, so back to your original question of what is it like for these students then in the lab here at Vassar. Yeah. Again, if you were to walk into the laboratory that I described, on a day we're doing the experiments, you might find an undergraduate that is personing the video camera, another undergraduate that's in charge of the computer that's recording the accelerometer data. Somebody's in charge of making careful notes, right? And then after we get done with the experiments, they would sit down and analyze the videos. And then we'd get together and talk about, okay, what do we have here? Do we go on to the next generation or do we have a mistake? And so we structure during the academic year, these experiences for our students in a number of ways. So we use a tutorial type thing, but the tutorial is, okay, let's get in the lab and do stuff. It's very much old-fashioned apprenticeship. Come into the workshop. Here are the tools we use. Learn how to use the tools. I'll show you first, okay? Then I'll watch you do it standing there, and then I'll leave in stage three, and you'll do it, and then we'll come back and see how you did. So it's that kind of old-school apprenticeship, and then what I really enjoy about our students here at Vassar is they learn quickly. They become very skillful so that they then become mentors for new apprentices
new students coming into
the laboratory. Yeah. So what we end up having are collaboratives, if you will, where we have this mix of new people and old people who are in the lab. And I don't mean physically old, although I would be among those. But, you know, so we have a mix of skill levels.
Yeah.
And so it's that is very much like being a graduate student in the sciences as well, where you go into a lab and you learn a lot from the other students and only a little bit from the so-called principal investigator. So my goal for any student coming into the lab is that they figure out what they want to do with their life. And some of the time that means, you know what, John, I hate doing science. Yeah. This is so boring. I can't stand it. I want to go.
Yeah.
I had some student a few years ago who was very promising in the lab, and I won't tell you his name, but we worked really hard to get him experiences during the academic year. During our ERSI program that Vassar runs, the Undergraduate Research Summer Institute, he was with us for a summer there, and then he said, you know what, the next summer I want to go to Caltech because it's a great university, and let me go work on animal behavior at Caltech. So we put together an application for him, and I had to work with him on this. It was worse than applying to graduate school to get a summer internship at Caltech. And he got the internship, you know, and I had to, you know, pull strings and talk to people I knew and that sort of thing. But he was a great student, and I'd taken him to scientific meetings, so people had seen him present and were very excited about his potential as a PhD-level scientist. So he gets to Caltech, and then he comes back in the summer, and he's like, John, I have to talk to you. I said, uh-oh, what's going on? So he sat down, and he was looking, not giving me good eye contact and things, and he said, John, I don't want to do science anymore. Do you hate me? And I'm like, no, of course I don't hate you. The point is to figure out what you want to do.
Sure.
Right? And so, you know, and I said, so it's fine. So what do you want to do? And he said, well, let me tell you why I don't want to do science anymore. He said, so I was there at Caltech with graduate students and postdocs. And, you know, so I'd work a full day and I'd start at 8 o'clock, maybe get done at 6. Then I'd come back the next morning when we'd be sitting down at lunch. And these other folks would be talking about what they'd been doing and thinking about after 6 o'clock. Yeah. And he said, and they were all thinking about their science. And he said, I realized I didn't want to spend all of my conscious life thinking about science.
Day and night, yes.
Yeah. And not that you have to, right? But I think for him it was a gut check of, is this my passion or why am I doing it? And so he uncovered some of his motives, which were, gosh, I think I'm doing this because both of my parents have PhDs, right? Yeah. So what is he doing now? He said to me, so we got through this, and he said, okay, now do you hate me? And I'm like, of course not. I don't hate you. So, but how can I help you do whatever it is you want to do? And, and what is that, by the way? And he said, well, I want to be an actor. And here he is, a senior, telling me this. I'm like, well, you know, it's pretty competitive, so why don't you go talk, of course, to the folks in drama? And the folks in drama said, well, ha, 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 you no way you're going to be in our shows because we have all these seniors who've been working their whole career to get into these shows.
Yeah.
And so this person said, well, what do I do? And they said, well, go to L.A. or go to New York and try to get bit pieces and things like that. Work through that way. And he said, well, can I go to graduate school, get my MFA in acting? And they said, no way. You know, nobody's going to let you in. You don't have any experience. So here's what he's done. He's in New York. Turns out he's a really good stand-up comic. And he wins comic competitions. And he drives his other actor friends crazy because he has a day job. He can work as a science technician, earning a decent salary with health benefits. He doesn't have to work nights. So he can go to auditions in the evening. He can do evening shows.
So,
and he's combined this. So that, to me, is the best part of working with these young collaborators in the lab, is whether they go into science or not, watching them do the things they do.
Follow them around. You're talking about C.P. Snow and the two cultures. You know, it occurs to me, something Molly Nesbitt, chair of the Department of Art, said to me a while back when we were talking about technology. She said, technology is all about oral culture, and it's not about writing. And I thought about that. I worked with the Media Cloisters when it was up and running in the library there, and it's true. Much of what takes place in the same kind of environment you're talking about, where you've got students learning from students, and everybody's talking to one another all the time. And that seems to be the case in the science. And that it's not that there isn't a lot of writing that's done in the sciences. I mean, tons of research reports and articles produced, but scientists, I imagine, they don't tend to spend a lot of time sitting reading. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe it depends on the individual and the project, but people talk to one another, and they're always talking to one another, which is not the case in the humanities. Apart from the occasional colloquia, there's not much actual verbal communication going on. It's all reading and writing, outside of the classroom I'm talking about. Are the sciences, is it a kind of oral culture as opposed to a written culture?
There is, you know, it's interesting. We do have a written culture in them. In the papers we produce that go through the peer review process that get published in Science and Nature and so forth. But those are already, by the time they're published, at best, they're already 3 to 6 months out of date.
Yes.
So you're right. The oral culture is, if you're on the cutting edge, as it were, you are talking to other people. You have a problem, you call somebody up at another institution. There is definitely a web of collaboration that extends beyond your home institution. And you see this in an interesting way. When you try to write a paper, and we submit a paper for peer review, you can suggest to the editor possible reviewers. So there's this game that goes on. The sociology of it is you want to pick people who you think are reasonable and constructive, but they can't be people that you've collaborated with because that disqualifies them based on conflict of interest. But you don't want to pick known jerks either, because you actually want your paper to be published. And in the best way, you know, you want a really good, careful review that helps you make your science better, right? You don't want just somebody to say, oh, yeah, yeah, it's great, go ahead and publish it, because then you publish something and somebody says a year later, hey, this was no good. Why didn't you recognize this problem?
So the critiques are very important.
So the critiques are important. So part of that is you end up getting to know people. You find out who is reasonable, and they become, in that formal process, then your judges in the selection game, speaking of evolution.
Speaking of evolution, yes.
Right, that is part of this scientific peer review process.
It's a fish-eat-fish world.
So,
you know, speaking about writing, what was it that motivated you to do a book? I mean, I assume that the results of your experiments are published in the usual scientific media, scientific journals, but what motivated you to do a monograph?
Well, I didn't want to do it at first.
No.
I had talked in the past to academic publishers. about writing books. Part of my background is in biomechanics, mm-hmm. writing books on biomechanics or writing books on biorobots or biomimicry and things like that. And it was always a situation where we would sit down with an editor and we'd talk about this. I would ask the editor, so why should I do this? Mm-hmm. The editor would say, well, it's going to take a long time. It's going to take about 18 months, maybe, if you're lucky. And but then you will have carved out a piece of this academic world that's sort of associated with your name. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, well, okay, that's fine. But in science, what I need to do is I need to try to get funding to keep my laboratory going.
Yeah.
And there isn't a funding agency out there, of which I know anyway, that cares a darn about you writing a book. They want those peer-reviewed papers coming out in the scientific mm-hmm. journals.
Yes.
So the currency of science is not in books. It's actually in the journal publication.
Yes.
So I would sit there and I go, okay, so it would actually hurt me because then I wouldn't be publishing in journals while I'm writing this book. And then, and I'd say, and as far as I know from academic books, you don't make any money, right? So they're going to, like, yeah, we'd hope to sell about 2,000 copies.
Yeah.
Which go mostly to libraries and graduate students and that kind of thing.
500 sometimes.
Okay, so 500. Yeah. So the benefits of doing it for me never seemed to sort of outweigh the costs because I want to keep being a productive scientist.
Yeah.
So in 2009, Vassar's own Jeff Kosmacher, who's our director of public relations, knew about the work that we were doing on robotics in the laboratory, and he went out and he got the Associated Press interested in our research such that they sent both a print reporter and photographer and then, secondarily, a videographer and reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And they jointly released, the Associated Press did, a print for newspapers mm-hmm. and then a video for TV stations. Huh. They released a story on our laboratory. So that was great of Jeff.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a huge, wonderful publicity thing that he did for us. And as a result of that, I got an unsolicited email from a literary agent. And she said, hi, my name is Laura Wood, and I would like to talk to you about writing a book. Well, having already talked to these academic editors and honestly being totally ignorant about trade publications, I'm like, okay, great, we'll talk, but you know, I don't think this is going to work out very well. So we're talking, and I'm asking her these same questions, you know, things like, well, why should I do this? And she's like, well, it's a way for you to reach out, have a broader audience. And I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. But I'm hemming and hawing. And she says, well, and I said, you know, this is going to take a lot of time out of my research life. Why would I do this? And she said, well, you're a teacher, right? And she said, don't you want to reach a larger audience? And I said, oh, well, yeah, but it's only going to sell, you know, maybe a couple thousand copies. And she said, oh, no, no, no. We expect it to sell many more thousands of copies, right? So you'll have, you really have a broader audience when you write one of these trade books. And I said, well, duh, of course, you know, I've read these trade books, and of course they have a bigger audience. And I said, okay, well, I'm listening now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And actually she said, and besides, you don't have to do peer review. And
no,
I said,
oh,
well, that's interesting. Right. I don't have to have academics approve of this book.
Yes.
Now, obviously, I would have to have the editorial staff at Basic Books, as it turned out.
Yeah, you'd have had to have written it very differently with a lot more constraints, and it wouldn't have been as interesting, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. So now I'm really listening. Then I'm getting the cynic in me is going, now, wait a minute. How are you going to make your money, Laura? What is it that you get out of this? And she said, well, I get 15% of your advance.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, advance?
Yes.
What advance?
Yeah.
And she said, my job, this is Laura speaking, my job is to help you write a book proposal, which is a sample chapter, an outline. We tell the publishers about who you are. I can get in the doors in New York City to all the publishers. I'm known there. You know, I've got a history.
Yeah.
I've been a publisher before.
Yeah.
She worked for Duke University Press. She worked for Barnes & Noble. She said, I can get in the doors and I can get your proposal read because not even nonfiction these days gets unsolicited review. You have to go through an agent. And so I said, all right, let's give it a shot. So I put together a proposal and then she walked it around and it was mostly rejections, but Basic Books was interested. So we signed with them. So it was sort of an accident of the publicity that Jeff had provided through the Associated Press. Laura, thinking that she really had the concept of the book, she said, you know, you need to write a book on evolving robots. I'm like, well, cool, I can do that. And then it was somebody at Basic Books, the editor there, the acquisitions editor, T.J. Kelleher, who said, ooh, I want to do this project. And so those three people I really credit with giving me the opportunity, seeing the possibilities, framing it in such a way that made sense to me. Now, back to your point about doing this as a scientist, why do you do something like this and reaching out to a broader audience? It has been really interesting to me to operate in this new zone, right, where, I mean, the fact that we're sitting here doing this on radio is really kind of cool to have this opportunity to do this and think about I don't know how many people listen to your show or your podcasts, but think about maybe stimulating the curiosity of people who hadn't thought about robots and biology in this way. Yeah. So that does appeal to me as a teacher.
One of the things that motivates me to do this show is that there is a lack of understanding or a kind of rift between what we do in higher education, what goes on here, and what the general public conceives what we do, you know. And yeah. What happens here is very interesting, and a lot of it happens with taxpayer money, especially in the sciences. And people
True.
Really ought to know what we do, especially, as I say, it is very interesting. And, you know, the more we can get academic discourses to inform other kinds of discourses, also political discourses in particular, but also other yeah. kinds of discourses, the better I think it will be for everybody.
Well, you know, you raise a really good point. And Sue Vinette, who is an assistant manager at our bookstore here, the Barnes & Noble
yes.
bookstore at Vassar College,
well.
Boy, she's a wonderful force of nature.
Yes.
And she saw this book came out, and she said, John, I need to talk to you. And I didn't know her,
yes.
right? And actually, I'd come into the bookstore, and I'd said, hi, I've never written a book before, but I've seen other professors have their books here. How do I get you guys to have my book on the shelves? And she said, oh, you wrote this, huh? And she talked to me about it. And very soon, she hatched her own plan. She said, I'm all about the education of girls in science. We need to do something with the local school systems. So next thing you know, last spring, right when the book is coming out, I'm giving presentations to New Paltz and Spackenkill, some of the local districts, and talking to middle schoolers and high schoolers about doing robotics and biology because of Sue and her interest in doing this. It was a wonderful kind of opportunity that she gave me, just of the type that you're talking about, which is, can you bridge between what's sometimes seen as an esoteric pursuit into something that's really going to impact the way that people are thinking about the world?
Exactly. So Isaac Asimov, a great science writer as well as a science fiction writer, once commented that the most exciting phrase in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, isn't Eureka, but that's funny. And my question is, was he right with regard to your own work?
I think that there's a lot of that's funniness going on in the laboratory, right?
Yeah.
Just to give you a recent example, we realized when we were doing these evolutionary experiments that we weren't doing any kind of evolution of the brain itself, right?
Right.
So we're doing these experiments we set up to see if the number of vertebrae would increase. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't.
Yeah.
To play with that predator detection threshold, you know, can you, your lateral line sensory system and the shape of the tail. Brain is not evolving.
Mm-hmm.
So we run through 10 generations, and under certain circumstances, certain selection, what we see is that the number of vertebrae are increasing. These animals, listen to me, these robots that are animal models, at the same time are getting better at feeding and escaping predators. We can measure that change in behavior. And behavior is what natural selection sees, if you will. That's what gets judged.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, oh, wow, this is really cool. You know, this selection pressure, when you've got a predator in there, really makes a difference. And then Josh DeLeu, who was working with us at the time, had this great sort of moment like, oh, this is funny. He said, hey, now, wait a minute. They're getting better at doing this. Wouldn't you say they're getting more intelligent? It's like, yeah, sure, they're doing a better job at escaping predators and feeding. That's definitely intelligence, right? And he said, yeah, but we haven't touched the brain. It's like, right, isn't that cool?
Yes.
This is being more intelligent when it's judged by behavior, by changing your body. And so this is this really cool insight about embodiment, right?
Yes.
That brains don't exist. Information, to your point, doesn't exist independent of what
of
instantiates
body.
That agent, right? What gives it agency.
Yeah.
And so here we've actually shown, on accident, by surprise, that you change the way your body is built and you become smarter based on the body alone.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and you know, it speaks to this idea that as humans, we're so neurocentric, right?
Yes,
we're so focused on our big
brain.
Well,
we've got this idea, you know, we inherit from Descartes that the mind and the body are entirely separate things, and the body is basically the servant of the mind. So, you know, you get with good old-fashioned artificial intelligence this idea that there is no, I mean, there's no reason for the body. And that.
That's right. It's just the software, to use the computer analogy. And that's certainly not true. So that was a wonderful sort of, oops, wow, look what we did here.
When we think of robots in science as well as science fiction, we think of efforts to develop autonomous creatures that mimic, say, people, and that function and think, perhaps, and even replicate themselves in some way on their own as living creatures do. And in fact, automatons have occupied the dreams of human beings for as long as we have written records. Homer describes in the Iliad, for instance, two golden robots made by Hephaestus to help him get around because of his lameness. And I know, you know, what you're doing here with your models isn't about creating new life forms. It's about coming to terms with concepts about actual life, life in the past. But, you know, my question is, whatever your specific objectives, can what you're doing be construed in a way as being part or driven by this larger dream of the robot, which seems to really loom over modern technology in a way and almost emblemizes technology. And I've often thought it does so in part because if you think of technology as that which we use to extend our senses into the world, our bodies, you know, our minds, the robot's a perfect instantiation of this in a sense because
right.
it is, you know, right. it is just that. So,
so yes.
Yes, okay. So.
Yes, to what you said. No, I think that it's definitely true. And that's why I'm so glad that I've got colleagues that I have in the cognitive science program here who've really been tutoring me over the years. So Ken Livingston, Gwen Browdy, Carol Christensen, Jan Andrews, about the central concepts in cognitive science and artificial intelligence, because part of the framework in CogSci is a philosophical framework. And biologists are really bad philosophers. Most of the reasoning we do is implicit. Mm-hmm. It's not explicit. We're not conscious of the logic we're using. We just assume there's a scientific method and there's not.
Yes.
You know, is it Bayesian? Is it hypothetical deductive methodology a la Popper? Mm-hmm. You know, there are lots of different ways to be thinking about
sure. So
the way we reason.
C.P. Snow would be very surprised and delighted by what you're doing. Yes.
Well, that's good to know. Yeah. And so to your point about the dreams of life or lifelike machines, that's not something that motivates me to do the work, but it's something that I end up worrying about. And I mean, in the best way. I end up cogitating, thinking, talking out loud with people about it. What is life? You know, what is it that gives us this life?
Yeah.
And so right now, one of the ways that this comes up is when people will say to me, so you're evolving robots. Does that mean you're building Skynet and Skynet's going to take over or the Cylons?
Yeah. There are these myths that immediately come
or
to
Gollum
mind.
Of the Jewish myth, built from clay.
Yeah, Frankenstein.
Frankenstein and everything like that. So, and what I say to them is, look, nobody right now has any idea how to build a machine that will be self-aware and conscious the way we worry about humans doing that, right? We don't even know how humans do this. You know, even though neuroscience tells us a lot about consciousness, it's not everything.
Even though Watson was a very good Jeopardy player.
I mean, Watson's fantastic. Yeah. You know, wonderful machine, deep question and answer machine. But that these questions right now, I'm not worried about the singularity that Kurzweil describes, the technological singularity where suddenly our machines become smarter than us and they take over. Honestly, our machines are already smarter than us, right?
Yes.
They're different than us. And so as a biologist, so here's where I really love having one mental foot in the world of biology.
I think Kurzweil is a Cartesian here, really. So
yes,
the
exactly.
Absolute difference between the body and the mind, the body being essentially absorbed or taken over by the mind.
So from a biology point of view, what we see is a diversity of life forms and a diversity of ways of making a living. And that making a living is really hard in the sense that we don't have machines yet who can reproduce themselves. Mm-hmm. So this is one sort of essential piece of autonoetic existence that we haven't solved with our machines yet, the machines that can make its machine. That, to me, is a really interesting point, right? Until we have that, any other machine that might worry us, you unplug it or you wait till it breaks. I mean, robots are actually pretty brittle.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine how long does your car work before you need to put oil in it or gas in it. So these machines would have to figure out how to reproduce, which is essentially like healing yourself or repairing yourself. They would have to be able to harvest their own energy, which is another thing that animals do without thinking about it, right? Yeah. That's just part of the game of life. And right now we don't have very good energy harvesting. We're dependent on supplying our machines with energy. So I don't worry about the technological singularity because at least in my limited kind of brain, I can't see how this is going to happen yet. And I haven't seen anybody write, okay, if you lay down the plans for this, nobody knows. So some people hope, oh, it's going to be poof, this emergence. I think what's really happening is we're living the robotic revolution right now, and we incorporate different kinds of intelligence into our life.
Yes, that was my follow-up question. What does it mean to be artificial? Gregory Bateson once asked the question, is the blind man's cane a part of the blind man? You know, we live in a world where what it means to be a human being is becoming more and more challenged by our own technological interventions. In biomedical devices, for instance, prostheses of all sorts, but with other types of common technology also. For instance, I don't seem to need a brain that remembers anything anymore. As long as I have my iPhone handy, I can always take a picture of something or look something up.
Yep.
So apart from the dystopian Kurzweilian prediction you mentioned that we're all going to be assimilated into a coming singularity of human and machine consciousness, or that our machines are going to rise up and sweep us away like Skynet or Rossum's robots, there are people who have a positive utopian and certainly more world-friendly take on what is sometimes called post-humanism. Catherine Hales, for instance, writes about the possibility for new hybrid forms of subjectivity that break down hierarchies and power structures based on geography, class, gender, etc., but more importantly, also break down the assumptions that drive our relationships with other biological forms, so that we might conceive of a state of being where we have a sense of shared or hybrid identity with fish, for instance, in a way that we do not know, or even with inanimate things. In other words, that we'll stop thinking of ourselves as wholly self-regulating subjects that are differentiated from and independent of other material forms, both animate and inanimate. So since you're one of the few people on the planet who is actually working on a daily basis right on this line between what it means to be a life form and what it means to be a thing, do you ever find yourself making these kinds of elisions? In other words, has your work changed your consciousness in any way concerning what it means to be human or alive even?
Yeah, so yes. So, I totally am daily thinking about these issues, right? And part of it, again, as a biologist, mm-hmm. I'm all the time just thinking about humans as animals mm-hmm. and our behavior as animals yes. and that we're not these yes. idealized rational agents mm-hmm. here. We're have lots of irrational automatic processes mm-hmm. occurring. So there's that, and then there's this ability or this vision or this understanding that we create this technology, and so, in essence, we're already intimate with it. We create technology in order for it to work with us. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of the shock of the new. It's a matter of the accommodation of the new with the things we're doing. And this is how you see commercial technology be constantly reincorporated into our lives.
So I want to thank you, John, for joining us today on the Library Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tom.
We've been talking with John Long, professor of biology and cognitive science here at Vassar College, about his book, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology, chosen by The New Scientist as one of the top five books published this spring. You've been listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR Independent Radio 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie. And stay tuned for this important public service message.